Hey, it's Greg. This is the Square Pizza Pod, cooked up by Sherm Co.
Hey everyone, thanks for coming back to another episode of the Square Pizza Pod. Today we have Daniel Velasco as we continue to support and uplift Hispanic Heritage Month. Daniel is the Chief Operating Officer at Latinos for Education, where he brings deep experience in education, entrepreneurship, fundraising, and strategy. In this episode, you will learn how Latinos for Education came to be, why disaggregation is needed across all levels to understand disparity, how charter and district schools can work together or learn from each other, and so much more. I hope you guys enjoy this one.
All right. Pretty good. Good to be here with you. Yep. Wonderful. You're coming to us from Jacksonville. Is that right?
Yeah. I'm home this week.
How was Jacksonville today?
It's good. It's this is where we are in Florida. It's a high of 80 today. Beautiful weather. Yeah, beginning of fall.
And I think I recently found out Jacksonville is the second largest city per square footage behind Houston. Is that close?
It is the largest city. The
largest. It's big. It's larger than Houston.
Yeah, in the continental U.S. So the only city, the only larger cities are actually in Alaska. That's because the city of Jacksonville back in the 70s absorbed Duval County. They became a single one. So it's really, I think it's about 1 million people, but really spread out.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Hurts my urban planning heart, but you know, important for others too.
Right. Yeah.
And before we get started, officially definitely going to get into it more, but want to recognize and say happy Hispanic Heritage Month for everybody out there, but also all the work you guys are doing as well.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
And I think one thing that came up, Dr. Velasco, in our research is you're a little bit of a travel buff. I'm curious if you can tell the people what you enjoy about traveling so much. And perhaps, I know it's kind of hard when you always ask the favorite place to travel because everyone is probably unique, but curious if any stand out to you.
Yeah, I think I grew up traveling a lot. My dad was a foreign service worker for Peru. And so because of that, our parents had lived all over the world by the time they had us and then made a point to take us places. So they would often take us everywhere. So, you know, I've also lived in like six different countries and all over this country. And I find that I don't have a favorite place or some places I've gone back to, like the Dominican Republic or Mexico City, that I just love. Mm-hmm. I think Latin culture is something that's really close to my heart for obvious reasons.
Sure.
So those spots I go back, but actually we just got done booking a delayed 5-year anniversary trip, delayed by COVID.
Right.
To Kenya next year to see a buddy of ours that lives there now and to hopefully go on safari or do some beach. So yeah, that's what's on the docket. Hopefully we can do it because, you know, like so many people, we've had to cancel so much of our life, but we get a lot of energy, my husband and I, from travel. So
that's great. First time to Kenya or Africa?
To Kenya, yes, but no. We actually did our honeymoon in South Africa when we first married. And we'd been to, I had been to Egypt with my family. And we went to Morocco a few years ago. So we like it. We just haven't been enough. And now that we have a buddy that lives in Nairobi, been there a couple of years. And so he's already visited Jacksonville twice. And when we first started to talk about planning it, he's like, we said September of next year, and he said that's too far away.
Yeah. It's a good friend right there. Put the pressure on
you. Yeah.
Let's go. Yeah, hopefully that goes smooth and Southwest and all the other airlines have everything figured out by this point to get there safely.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, Dan, you got an incredible background, which we could probably spend a lot of time on. I'm sure we'll touch on, but you currently serve as the Chief Operating Officer for Latinos for Education. And we'd love for you to just, you know, we're going to get deeper into the day-to-day work, but can you tell us how that organization came to be an organization?
Oh, sure. So we got started about 5 years ago. I was the second hire after CEO and someone else. Our friend RD Leva, who I think you know as well. But the organization was started by Amanda Fernandez, who's our current CEO and founder. And the genesis of it is, I think, not rocket science, but fairly evident as we, you know, she looked around and realized there's no one kind of aggregating Latinos. So many of us have had this sort of circuitous journey through education, both as children in the system and then as teachers and administrators and leaders. I remember talking to her as she was getting started with the idea, even because we'd met a few years before the organization was started. And it was so clear, right? Like, we kept being asked to be, there was a handful of us kept being asked to be on everything, right? Every committee, every mayor's thing. I'd recently had a commendation from this like mayor of New York for national service. And I was truly baffled by that because I felt like there were plenty of other people doing really important work. Mm-hmm. Not that I didn't think my work back then was important, but I realized that the sort of pedigree I brought, all these sort of white dominant culture medals I'd been aggregating over time, made it easy to hand me a mic or spotlight me. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of sat with that, right? That like, I'm benefiting from this system that is celebrating these metrics that are, you know, aren't truly authentic to how I view worth. And so I reached out to Amanda. She'd just gotten her first grant from the good people at New Schools Venture Fund.
They were, shout out to Francis Masano and the team. We had a recent
episode. I know she was with you a little while ago. So they're incredible. And we started with the Latino Board Fellowship. So I first came on to help design some of the programs. And as I was helping to do that, we kept extending the number of weeks I was essentially as a consultant because I still had a full-time job. And as I was doing that, it became more and more evident that what I had been getting ready to do was this, mm-hmm. right? It wasn't to go off and, you know, go down the superintendency track or commissioner track. It was to help create programming and offerings that were helping to sort of shine a light on a pathway for more people. So I quit my job and came here full time. And that was about close to 5 years ago. And so it's been a good journey. We've built a lot in the last few years.
I appreciate that context. And I think first, before going farther, like important to recognize and shout you all out as the organization doing this work specifically, because as you said, others were maybe tiptoeing around it, but it always takes a group of people to do it, to put the work together, to write the grants, to build it out, to build the systems, to really name this is
Amanda a part-time job just to go write the strategic plan.
Yeah.
Right? So no income, no grants. It was just like an idea. So absolutely. I came on when we already had a little bit of money.
Maybe not advised to quit the full-time job before starting, slowly ease into that.
Yeah. Well, I joke that, you know, it wasn't until we had five or six people that we could even offer benefits. Yep. So that's a real like startup story, right? Like you can't do that. A lot of people couldn't come here because we wouldn't have benefits. Like you have to have enough of a like mix really to be able to take a leap into a startup, you know?
Well, you know, you may not know this, but I my side hustle is a small business owner called with Shrimco, and I recognize how hard it is to get benefits for staff members when you're not podcasting and getting
100%.
It's a very real thing. I appreciate you sharing that. And then, you know, 5 years in and going to talk about, you know, the recent State of Latino Education conference that you guys put on, which was really powerful. But can you give the listening audience kind of an overview of the work you all do at Latinos for Education?
Oh, sure. So we're a national education nonprofit. We're based out of Boston. We aim to identify, place, develop, and connect what we think is essential Latino leadership in the education sector. We do that through both programmatic work, so leadership development, accelerating people into and through the education sector from the classroom to the boardroom, and also through advocacy work. So working both at the state level, city and state level, and the geographies where we operate, and currently in Boston and in Houston, but also through national advocacy. So working directly with the Department of Education and the White House around the types of policies that we know are needed to help support our children and families through the education sector. That's kind of the high level of the work that we're doing these days.
And I think you have some, well, you, not that I think, you do have some really powerful data and programs on the website. But two kind of related data points that stuck out to me on the front page, 4% of leaders on education board are Latino, and 2% of leaders are on executive teams in education orgs are Latino. Can you speak to that and why you all feel so strongly that it needs to kind of be represented on the homepage of the work?
Yeah, I mean, we don't want to be the only voice in the room or the only voice at the table, but we do want and deserve equitable representation in terms of educational programming, not only within schools, but the education sector at large, that is disproportionately serving our children, right? Mm-hmm. So we're going to be 1 in 3 children in the public school systems in the next couple of years. We're only about 8% of teachers nationally, 8 or 9%. We're only about 2 and 4%, as you just noted, in boards and leadership teams. And what that means is that the cultural competence and sort of the lived experience of the Latino community is consistently missing from these types of educational experiences that are being brought to our kids. And so we think that, I guess our big bet, if you will, is that if we put Latino children at the center of educational reform and programming on our way to serving our kids, we're actually going to serve all other children, because our kids just have such high level of disparity in terms of our access to resources. So if we make it easier for Latino children and families to access resources, we're going to serve low-income kids. We're going to serve emerging bilinguals, immigrant kids. And so we think there's a way to do that that is long-term, and that starts from bringing more teachers and finding ways to attract and retain Latino teachers. Mm-hmm. And I think part of that is why we also chose to do advocacy work hand in hand with that. We're not willing to, a few years ago, I would have said, I'm not going to trick Latinos into becoming teachers if there isn't going to be a pathway to the middle class for them through teaching in their communities. And so we've launched teacher facing and teacher retention programming through the Latinx Teachers Fellowship a couple years ago, at the same time that we were also working with legislators to help make sure there are those pathways, right? That we're providing, you know, debt forgiveness, and that there's pathways to credentialing that are providing sort of the guardrails that our community needs.
And it's so strategic to be able to do it and provide supports at the policy level, but also at the ground level, or at the teacher level as well, because as you said, we don't want to be supporting or inviting teachers into systems or environments that aren't safe or nurturing to them, or set them up for success as humans, and vice versa. If they're not set up for success as humans, likely can't be their best selves in front of kids in front of the classroom.
I mean, exactly that. Yep. You know, I think of my own experience as a teacher. I left the classroom after 2 years teaching in Silicon Valley because I lived with 5 other people. There wasn't a world in which I wasn't going to live with 5 other people if I wanted to help contribute at home, which many of us need to.
Sure.
And that kind of sucked because I was a good teacher, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm still in touch with a lot of my former kindergartners and their families. And I love that aspect of my career. And do feel like I missed out on being able to stay in the classroom.
No, I think that's right. And I don't know if I was a good teacher, but I enjoyed it and still keeping, you know, in touch with my kids as well. But to your point, you know, have many moments reflecting back when I was looking at a textbook or looking at new policies that were passed, thinking like, how in the hell did this get passed? And how is this going to help my kids? And how long is it going to take before this like ever hits the front of the classroom? So I think it's not easy for an organization to both be focused on the policy work and the day-to-day teacher work. But to your point, if not groups like yours, the disparities between the two often go without kind of being brought together.
Right.
And I think that kind of leads into a little bit of the recent, well, all the work, but also specifically the state of Latino education. Can you speak to kind of why you guys put that on and some of the outcomes of that?
Yeah, I mean, that was...
And congrats, even before you dive in, sorry to cut you off, but just for pulling that off, for getting some of the speakers you had on. I mean, the parts we were able to join were really powerful.
Yeah, our team did a spectacular job with that. I will say, like, you know, from my seat, we recently hired a chief policy and advocacy officer, Dr. Feliz Ortiz-Licón, who sort of masterminded pushing that through the last few months. It was definitely a huge team effort to get that event. It was multiple days across different geographies, all virtual, but we had, I think, close to 900 attendees across 3 days, which was awesome. We had something like 1500 or 1800 registrants. So we saw a really good conversion in terms of what you see in those types of virtual spaces, but we did that because it's never been done before. And I think that's the thing where we're not reinventing the wheel. We're just saying we need a spotlight. Like, just like, you know, there's Cancer Awareness Month or Breast Cancer Awareness Month, because breast cancer is such a powerful disease that is like tackling so much of our community and it gets a spotlight. Latino education needs to be spotlighted because our gaps are just that much larger. And we're just now going to start seeing the true effects of COVID on our communities. And so the data wasn't great 2 years ago. Like, it hasn't been great. It isn't good now. Like, it hasn't gotten better. It's only going to get worse over the next 2 or 3 years. And I don't say that, I guess, for those that know me, I'm a baseline optimist. Like, I enter the world like glass half full, right? And I feel like we're at the beginning of something fairly catastrophic unless we do we take some fairly bold actions in terms of shoring up the education sector. And that's not just for Latino kids, that's like at large. The profession is going to see a huge downturn in terms of people leaving the profession, because it's been really tough for folks working in schools. So our hope is that I've always thought of our advocacy work as sort of watchdogs, right? Like, we don't lobby, but we do bring together the folks that are expected to stand up for our kids. We get them to make commitments about what makes sense to our community, and then we will hold them to that. Right? We will circle back around. And this is not a one and done event. This is the beginning of ongoing research and convenings that will help to hold our elected and appointed officials to the fire, if you will, from a critical friendship vantage point, right? That we're not coming for them. We are helping to ensure that our voices and our community's needs are centered when decisions are being made on behalf of our kids. Recognize that, like, no one knows what we're doing. No one's dealt with COVID before, right? No one's dealt with the pandemic, but we weren't doing a great job before. And so we definitely don't want to go back to the way things were. Like, when people say re-enter, they say we want things to go back to normal. Normal was pretty crappy for a lot of kids and families. And so we're trying to rebuild in a different way, right? To like reconstruct, reimagine, re-engineer how the schools serve our kids.
I appreciate that. I think naming, you know, number one, that the previous reality pre-COVID was not great for many kids, particularly in under-resourced communities and adults either. I think two, to your point as well, reminding all of us that in these semi-heated or passionate conversations, we're all in the same communities, the same country, all want, for hopefully for the most part, all kids to have access to high quality education. And so if we can agree on some of those basic premises, perhaps we can work collaboratively together across political lines, you know, different education ideologies to really make sure we're moving in the right direction, to your point, because right now, and even pre-COVID, I think there's a lot of data points that prove we weren't moving in the right direction.
Yeah.
I think you, sorry, here, got messed up on my tabs. You know, continue to bring up those good points where I appreciate, and I think even going a bit deeper, you know, you and I have had conversations just about the importance of disaggregating data, but also the terms in which and the data we're looking at this sort of information. Can you talk about, you know, from your vantage point and your experience, why terms and language are important in this work as we're looking at data and then kind of building needs from that data?
Yeah. You know, I think there's our country's in a moment of racial awakening, if you want to call it that, right? I think we've had these like waves over the decades. I think we're in one. I celebrate that. I think that's great. I think we need to do more and be better. I think, unfortunately, the Latino lens or the Latino experience tends to get kind of ignored or clumped together as people of color. You know, we've talked about the term BIPOC, and it's a term I don't like because it inherently leaves out, like, it doesn't have a Latinos are kind of washed out of it. And so I find that oftentimes on whether it be boards or committees or, you know, where whenever I'm sort of witnessing data being presented, we get clumped as, you know, oh, we're going to bring in more teachers of color. It's like, I get that, but what does that actually mean for what is your target for Latino teachers? Because while we can, while like it's good for, you know, for us to have diverse teachers, we really need to start to close some of those gaps with Latino teachers, mm-hmm. right? In cities like LA and Houston and the Bay Area and New York, Boston, we have double digit gaps, right? Like from 11%, I think Boston Public Schools has Latino teachers to, I think it's about 44, 45% of the student body, right? So it's just like there's not even gaps. These are abysses. And so
to clarify for the audience, the gap we're talking about is, you know, equitable representation at the teacher level compared to the student level in those schools.
Yeah. Thanks for that. And so I think the nomenclature is important. I mean, even using the, you know, and this I'll say is a personal thing of mine. Like I tend to not use the term Hispanic because it's a term that was used, was created by, you know, the Nixon administration to just kind of clump us together during the census. And so I tend to identify more as Latino. And I think, and I even say, like, you know, Latino Heritage Month or Latinx Heritage Month. Mm-hmm. And that some of those choices are personal. But I think that when we don't at a baseline disaggregate the data and disaggregate the nomenclature, then it's very easy for us to continue to live in the shadows. And so part of it is that, is like giving it some light and some air, that some of the data is going to be messed up, right? Like it's not going to look good. We ran some of the data for Massachusetts, for example, and I want to say something like more than 70% of school districts in Massachusetts don't have a single Latino teacher.
17%.
70%. Yeah, there's, wow. I can send you the actual numbers of it, because last year I like got the data from the Department of Elementary and Secondary Ed. Hmm. And it was, I mean, what's the right terminology for it? It was really sad data. It was discouraging to see that, like, in a state where there are so many of us, where in the most populous city, we're 45% of the student body, we still haven't made, you know, our, like, taken the right steps, mm-hmm. that you have district, and I have a number for both, like, those that have less than five teachers and those that have zero, and it's, sure. like, more than 50% for both of them, and so it gives us a reason to exist, I suppose, from, like, a, like, viability, market need, if you will, but we know that there's a need for us, not only where we operate, but we're constantly being asked, like, why aren't you in the Bay Area? Why aren't you in Miami? Why aren't you in Arizona? Mm-hmm. And we'll get there. We're coming.
We got a lot to do here. Yeah. I mean, we'd certainly encourage our audience, and I appreciate lifting those up, to really take those terms and other terms into consideration, right? But also just the importance of understanding the data, disaggregating it in all the ways it should be, and then using it to really understand the best way to move forward with it. And I think you and I, from current and previous work and many others, know, sadly, without groups like yours, there's not many school districts or state level departments of education really looking at this data across educators and educators of color and students of color as well. So without groups like yours and understand the importance of it, there's, you know, to our knowledge, a lot of this data isn't even widely known, and not many responses happening because there's no data to even know what they're working towards.
It's, you know, maybe I get stuck in this terminology, but my husband's a cancer doctor. And so I think of it in this terms, like, until you can't treat cancer until you know it's cancer. Right. And so we can't treat this issue, this, like, endemic problem in our education industry, until we call it out and just, like, shine some light on it and, like, here is the problem. Now we can start to like create strategies to overcome it. But, you know, being in the room where like, I've been in the room where I've asked, like, what about the Latino numbers, or what about reading and writing and reading and math? Yep. And that data is not readily available. And so it's just kind of like wild goose chase to get it. So we just have to own, many of us didn't create the system, right? But we've chosen to step into it. And I think part of our onus, I suppose, is to help re-engineer it, right? The system is doing exactly what it was designed to do, which is to celebrate and uphold a certain community and to like keep other communities in the shadows and not with the same level of access. And so we have to tell the system to do something different. And I think that's sort of the painful work that takes time to do.
When you talk about, you know, re-engineering and kind of bold strategies to fix the current education system, you know, I think you personally have worked or at least supported educators in the traditional public schools, as well as kind of public charter schools as well. Can you talk about perhaps successes you've seen in both of those? And I think also in our work, right, we've seen biasly pros where those sorts of schools can collaborate and share best practices, whether it's around supporting educators of color, whether it's around best practices for family engagement or literacy or math. Curious about what you've seen from your own professional experience from both of those lens.
Yeah, I mean, I think I have worked in both. I will say at Latinos for Ed, we are agnostic. We think it's the wrong fight to have, like the public charter versus public district schools. Our communities don't actually care. Like we just want our teachers to be well-resourced. And our kids to have like competent, culturally sensitive teachers that, that are great at their craft. But so that said, having worked in both systems, full disclosure, I'm on a charter, National Charter Network board. But I also work hand in hand with, for example, Duval County Public Schools, like on my free time for free, to just advise wherever people ask for my opinion. And so I think where we've seen schools and systems take steps that have been successful, I would say wherever, I mean, not to shine a light on our own work, but to be honest, like it, we run a fellowship called the Aspiring Latino Leaders Fellowship, right? And right now we have about 60 participants that where school systems have bought seats for them in our program, right? And so we have Boston Public Schools, Yes Prep in Houston, Rocket Ship Public Schools in the Bay Area, and then a myriad of other district and charter schools from around those three geographies. That have said, like, we want our people to be in these spaces, right? And I think, you know, show me your budget and I'll tell you what you care about. I think a lot of school systems or leaders are always, you know, saying the right thing, but when it comes to actually allocating resources, people are always like, oh, sorry, we can't, you know, we can't invest.
It's true in the personal finance world too, for our friends out there struggling with personal finance.
And so, you know, I'll share something I found interesting. So a year and a half ago, we launched the Latinx Teachers Fellowship, and we decided to pay participants to be a part of it. We paid everyone $500 stipend to be a part of the summer program. We sort of showcased that when we spoke with Houston ISD, in like why we felt that that was important. And this last summer, they decided to directly pay participants that participated in our fellowship, which I think underscores again that like their professional development should be an investment that the district makes, because that is how both you retain people, that is how you attract people to come to your system, and that is how you give people a pathway to grow. So I've seen that. I know here in Jacksonville, there's some work happening around recruiting more Black and Latino male teachers that is sort of starting to blossom out. I think that has a lot of promise. I think those are the two that I would kind of point to right now.
Yeah, I appreciate you sharing. And I think too, to your point, if we can all come to a place where we want better educational systems and opportunities for all students, and we can acknowledge the previous system was not serving all students well, but that there may be pockets of excellence in a charter in the Bay Area and a district in the Tennessee area and another charter in Florida, like why not share resources? Why not understand that together kind of all boats can rise in this way. So I appreciate you sharing that perspective.
And I think that is a cultural change we're seeing, right? Okay. I think when you and I were teachers, which I think, you know, was probably the 2006,
2008.
Yep. Charters were felt to me like charters held their cards a lot closer to their chest. Yes. I've seen over the last maybe 5 or 8 years, a shift in that like modality, right? Where it's like, actually, there's probably sufficient resources mm-hmm. for us to like work together. I think of the sort of analogy, like we shouldn't be fighting for crumbs. We should just be making more bread. Mm-hmm. And I think that us coming together, bringing systems together, we make a point to bring district and charter staff together in all our programs, because I think for too long, we've kind of demonized each other, like the systems have demonized one another. And so once you've broken bread, not they keep pulling at the bread analogy here, but with people that are working in different systems, you start to see that there's value in both.
My guess would be because we have that shared experience of bringing those two parties together. When they get together, they're like, oh, you guys aren't that bad. We have the same, challenges. We're trying to figure it out. They kind of, I think in that experience want some sort of permission and a middle ground, a safe party to bring them together, to let them know it's okay to share these ideas, these best practices, without having one make the first move and invite them to enemy ground and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
We actually have a guest question in from Jahari Shelton. I'm going to paraphrase, and he gave you a meaty one, Dr. Vlasco. So, feel free to choose any part of this, meat or bread, as you know, if we want to keep using that metaphor here. So Mr. Shelton essentially asked, what social, organizational, and or political challenges stand in the way of more equitable representation between Latinx students and education leaders?
Ooh. And is meaty.
And you have 15 seconds. No, I'm joking. Yeah.
I think that we don't have the political will yet. I think that we've not made the right choices as society in terms of particularly how we choose to fund our schools. And so I think, and that actually happens at the local level. And so if you're wondering like, oh, what can I do? Like, go vote for school board members. Like, school board elections have really low turnouts. So find out how school board members are either appointed or elected in your city or county, because that is where like the lion's share of education spending is decided. And so we've codified spending on schools based on a zip code and based on property taxes by and large. And so that sort of broken system is going to continue to create the symptoms that we see until sort of the hand of civil society gets in there and says, actually, this is not okay. Yep. So I think that's probably the biggest question around it.
I think that's good. And it's a reoccurring pattern from guests on this podcast around not only how important it is to vote, consider running for school board comes up a lot. That actually our friends at the 8 Black Hands released their podcast yesterday or this morning, was all focused on encouraging leaders of color to run for boards of education. But also to your point around the education piece, not many know, right? Duval County, Charlotte Mecklenburg, $1 billion a year organizations, LAUSD, like with a B, mm-hmm. like really huge, incredible budgets.
Duval County has 120,000 students in its purview.
Yeah.
That's not nothing, you know.
No, think about even outside of budget, the logistics of busing and cafeteria and the amount of food, right? Like all these things. Like to your point, it doesn't get the credit, but perhaps organizations like yours continue to do great work to lift up the importance of that.
Yeah,
I'm gonna get you out of here on a few hopefully fun questions. Mm-hmm. We may have touched it, but I'm gonna ask you anyways, Dr. Vlasco. One actionable thing our listening audience can do to support your work?
Well, to support our work, follow us, right? Like we're a startup. Mm-hmm. Next week we'll be 21 strong. when there were 4 of us, we used to say we got to show up like a team of 10. Now that there's 21 of us, we try to show up like a team of 100. We can only do that in so much as we have ongoing support from people like you, Greg, and from the community, helping to elevate the work and amplify the impact of what our teams are trying to do. So if you don't follow us on social media and are not part of our network yet, please do that. But I would also say, other than yes, go register to vote. If you are not registered to vote, figure out who your school board members are. It's okay to be involved. You know, some people think that, you know, we put it in the trusted hands of our elected officials. Ask questions, you know, go to school board meetings. You'll be surprised how much you can learn and how influential your questions might be and how many more people might be wondering the same thing.
Yeah, appreciate that. And we'll definitely put all the links to support you all in our show notes and get the audience to do the same. Can you share what Square Pizza reminds you of?
Yeah, middle school cafeterias.
Positive or negative? You answer that pretty down the middle.
Yeah. I think positive. I think, you know, I finished middle school in the US. I went to three different middle schools in three different parts of the world and always started at different times of the year. But I do remember feeling a certain kind of joy on pizza day.
There we go. That's what we're going for. I appreciate that. So a little bit of a research question. Of those three middle schools in the world, I think some were international, as you said, did they all serve square pizza, or was this only a domestic treat in the United States?
It was just an American truth.
Okay.
I don't know. Yeah, no, definitely not in Latin America.
Probably for the best. Dr. Flasco, thanks for joining. Thanks for all the work you do. And we appreciate everything.
Thanks, Greg. Good to be here.
Thanks so much for checking out the Square Pizza Pod, making a few selfish requests. If you enjoyed the episode, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps spread the word about the podcast, and share this with a friend. We appreciate it. Thanks.